KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Doctors in Canada were shocked after pulling a 3-inch knife blade from the back of a 32-year-old man. The knife had been in there for 3 years. Imagine that. Guy had a knife in his back for 3 years, so he must have worked at NBC too.
He uses his piece to point out architectural features of the facade. And so those fingers of light that will move up the facade will be enliven the architecture to an amazing degree.
Virginia Wright on KUOW talking about the art and architecture of the city and the legacy that she and her husband have brought to the culture of the city. Also, you heard Jay Leno talking about the rumors, well, implying about the rumors, inferring the rumors of his replacement by Jimmy Fallon in the months ahead. One of the things we'll be talking about in our chat room a little later with Ralina Joseph, who's a professor at the University of Washington Communication Department, Roger Levesque, who's a former player for the Sounders and a graduate student at the UW now, and Mark Baumgartner, the editor-in-chief of the Seattle Weekly. That's a little later. Right now on the program, we're going to take another look at what's happening in Olympia. We need a theme. This week in Olympia. Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist for the Everett Herald. Hello, Jerry.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Week 11, the forecast for the budget came out. Everybody must have then started scrambling and submitting their budgets, right?
Well, scrambling is a good word for it. Nothing's been submitted to us in the public, but it is the 11th week, and it's time to get started. Everything up to now has sort of been like the preseason, and by next week, we should be ready for the real deal.
Well, they had $2 billion more than the current budget. The state has a $32.5 billion budget, but they had some pretty good news. It wasn't as big a shortfall as they thought. Have Republicans and Democrats in both bodies come together to come up with acceptable ideas to each other?
Well, you know, it seems possible. I mean, they do have more money projected to come in the next two-year budget, which actually gets underway July 1st of this year. But the other issue, and it's kind of a semantics issue in some ways, it's what does it cost to keep doing what we're doing and all the existing programs and services and laws that are on the books? What does that cost? And Democrats will tell you that if we pay for everything we said we're going to pay for, it's more than $32.5 billion. And so, in fact, they say, hey, there's a shortfall we have to eliminate, and then we need to put more money into education in line with what the Supreme Court said last week. Of course, the Republicans on the other side said $2 billion more is $2 billion more, and we can pay for everything. We don't need taxes, and we can comply with the Supreme Court. So that's where they're going to be fighting.
The governor is going to release his ideas for balancing the budget and putting more money into public schools. Any sense of what will be in there?
Well, I think what we're going to see is a list of what, and he has promised to provide a list of tax breaks that he wants to get rid of, and by doing so, that will generate an amount of money that we have no idea how much. I mean, his own budget person had put out in a press release last week, they thought they needed to put $1 billion more into education in order to comply with the Supreme Court. So theoretically, they're going to come up with a good chunk of that through closing tax breaks. Now, how viable is that? I mean, we've all heard about the tax breaks that everyone wants to close, and then when they get down to it, they can't seem to close any because there's always somebody out there that benefits and somebody wants to preserve their tax break. So, you know, he's going to go first, which is a little odd in my mind. And later this week, he'll put out his plan, and then the Senate and House will be able to put out their plans probably next week, and we'll start to really get down to the negotiating between the three sides.
Because of the really recent ruling by the court negating the two-thirds requirement, is it easier to sunset tax breaks this session?
Well, politically, it's not. Numerically, it is. I mean, if you only need 50% plus one to pass a bill to raise or get a tax or get rid of a tax break, it can go through in the House quite easily. The Democrats have, I think, 53, 54 votes to do that on almost any measure. But in the Senate, it's going to be difficult. The majority of 25 is 23 Republicans and 2 conservative Democrats. So, you know, they aren't going to be quick to get rid of a tax break, now, at least not initially. When you get down to crunch time and you really start talking, you know, 100 million here, 100 million there, they may be able to close the gap in some way. But initially, I think you're going to find a lot of resistance to eliminating any big money tax breaks. You know, last year they did one dealing with some banks, and it made them $18 million. So when you can make $18 million over a tax break, it's, you know, that's not going to make a difference anywhere.
Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist for the Everett Herald. I want to leave Olympia for a moment, Jerry, and ask you this. Boeing plans to lay off 800 by the end of the year, and that appears that the company and the union have expected these layoffs, but that's not good news for Snohomish County and not good news for the economy of Everett. Any sense of what impact these layoffs will have in the Everett area?
It's hard to tell right away because, as they say, that they have it. You know, it's sort of in what they expected. But the reality is, when you have 800 people who make pretty good money, suddenly not making that good money towards the end of the year, and they're going to be unemployed, you know, that is going to be less spending in the community and in the county. So I think it's going to hurt the economy. We are a retail sales based economy, and if people know they're going to be unemployed and they know they're going to have health care they're going to have to pay for. Out of that, they're going to spend less at the restaurants and in the stores. So I think in the short term, it's going to be a big hit. Whether or not they can get hired up again or find other jobs quickly, that's going to be the question. Or maybe they'll move out. Maybe there'll be jobs that Boeing will offer them in other communities, and they could go to other communities in Washington or to Wichita or even to South Carolina.
Have you spoken to any legislators in Olympia who are from the Everett area and ask them if there's a legislative action they are thinking of taking?
No, I haven't spoken to anyone directly, but in the past when these conversations have begun, they've sort of taken a hands-off of in terms of the economics of Boeing, unless it was something Boeing needed in the legislature. For example, the workers' compensation reform, unemployment insurance reform, or even some assistance through aerospace-related tax breaks. They've delivered on those in hopes of helping the company bottom line. But in terms of helping laid-off workers, they haven't come up with anything special over the last few years. Just coincidentally, Wednesday is Aerospace Day in Olympia. It's when executives and politicians speak to various aerospace organizations. And so it might get a little hint of whether folks have anything special they want to ask for. But at this point, workers are going to be without jobs by the end of the year, and the economy is going to have to, or the community is going to have to deal with that in their economy.
Probably won't want to see those manufacturing tax breaks go away.
Yeah, definitely don't want to see those. And you're going to hear a lot more about hiring and educating the next generation of engineers for Boeing. So they're not slowing down on their production. And folks who have lived here for a while know that these things kind of cycle up and cycle down. They got a new plane, the 787. They got it all. They built a whole bunch. Now some folks there, they don't need as much work on that. But the next generation of the 737 is right around the corner. And if they build it in Washington, those folks will probably be rehired quickly for that.
Well, speaking of education, the House Education Committee is holding a hearing on a Senate bill that would allow principals to fire teachers. What are the unions doing, and how will this bill be received in the more Democratic House?
Well, it's going to be interesting. Friday, it's at 1:30, the House Education Committee is going to have the hearing. The reason I think it'll be interesting because they're also going to have a work session on evaluation of teachers and principals. So the chair of the committee is trying to lay a tone saying, hey, let's see what we're doing in the classroom and on the campuses as it relates to quality teachers and then talk about the bill. I don't know if the bill is going to get out of the House, at least not in its current form. There's a lot of power for principals to, decide who works where in their school. And that's a big concern for the unions, which have in the past, gone out on the streets into some of the districts of the lawmakers who voted for the bill when it passed the Senate. I mean, they were sort of protesting against Senator Tom recently, and over the weekend, they were out knocking on doors in Senator Steve Hobbs' district in Lake Stevens saying, hey, you're voting for these bills, but you're not talking about funding schools, which is what the Supreme Court says you should be talking about. And so I don't know that the reform bill is going to get out as written, but it is going to help focus the discussion on education funding by the end of the week.
What impact will the hearing in the Senate on the DREAM Act, which would allow those in the country illegally to qualify for state financial aid? The House passed it, but now the Senate Higher Education Committee is going to hear it.
Yeah, it's sort of the flip side of that education reform bill. It's the Senate seemed a little reluctant, or at least the Senate Higher Education Committee chairwoman, Barbara Bailey, it seemed reluctant to want to have a hearing. Now there will be a hearing, but, you know, a hearing is only step one. If the committee, if she doesn't bring it up for a vote in the committee and it doesn't move out of that committee, it's dead. But by having a hearing, you can at least say, look, we talked about it, and we just decided it wasn't one of the priorities of our coalition. And so I think the real question is, after the hearing, which is Thursday, will they move it out by, I believe it's April 3rd is the deadline, to move some of these policy bills out of the committees?
Also, we're looking at some election-related bills, and you came across one that affects college campuses.
Yeah, there's a lot of bills trying to figure out how to save money or help voters this cycle. And I noticed one that the House passed is pretty partisan vote. Democrats pushing it, Republicans resisting. That says, you know, those drop boxes for ballots, they become increasingly popular around the state. They want them put on the campuses of community colleges and four-year universities to help, you know, increase the participation of students. The argument being, you know, there's a lot of people in one area, they should be voting and being able to have a ease of where they put their ballots. But the Republicans see it kind of as a tactic by Democrats to increase the number of ballots cast by one of their base support groups.
Well, this Saturday is Booth Gardner's public memorial in Tacoma. That will be a time when a little bit of partisanship put aside for at least the moments of those memorial.
Yeah, it's at 11 a.m. at the Field House, the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, and it is open to the public if folks want to participate. I think folks should be prepared for, you know, at least a 90-minute, maybe two-hour ceremony, because I understand the number of people who wanted to speak was long. It was a long list of folks who have worked with and been a friend of Booth Gardner's for years. And, you know, they had a bit of a tribute and memorial service of sorts on Friday in the legislature. They had a rare joint session, pretty far into the session, to have the House and Senate together. And so they paid tribute then, but the public will have a chance this Saturday. I mean, he will be known a lot, maybe for many even better, for the Death with Dignity Act that he helped pass in 2008. But he was a two-term governor who many thought he could have easily been a three-term governor. He was still very popular when he decided not to run for re-election. So, you know, he's got a long legacy in the state.
Jerry Kornfeld, we're in 11 weeks into the state legislative session, and I appreciate you keeping us abreast of what's going on.
Hey, whenever I can do.
Thank you. Jerry Kornfeld is a reporter, columnist for the Everett Herald. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
In a minute here, KUOW's Marcy Silman talks with Virginia Wright about art and philanthropy and the mark Virginia and her husband Bagley Wright have made on the city of Seattle. That's right around the corner.
Support for KUOW comes from the retina doctors at Vitreo Retinal Associates of Washington, currently enrolling patients in a clinical trial testing an investigational drug to treat dry, age-related macular degeneration. Participation information is at vrawashington.com.
52 degrees and partly sunny in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to reach 60 this afternoon. 1019, I'm Bernard Ouellette. A bit later this hour, we'll be talking over the news and cultural stories that are shaping the Seattle zeitgeist. Raylina Joseph, Roger Levesque, and Mark Baumgarten join us in 20 minutes.
Yesterday, the Seattle Art Museum closed down First Avenue for a public celebration of its newest permanent artwork, Mirror. It's an electronic interactive installation on the northwest side of the museum building. Above the main entrance, Marcy Silman.
I've been covering it.
You've been covering it.
It's interesting. Doug Aitken, who's the artist, had filmed a lot of scenes and iconic Northwest imagery and loaded them into a computer program that's going to project them. You can think of this glass like a movie screen, and it's like a wraparound thing. But the film that we see responds to instantaneous environmental stimuli, and I don't ask me how it works, but you can think of it as sort of sensors that are built into these screens. And so traffic, people walking by, the weather, those inputs are going to go to the computer program and change what is projected onto the museum.
And giving a sense of, so this is the artist. This is where the artist is having the
influence. Right. This is the conversation. He calls this like a living building. It's a live conversation, which is interesting in and of itself. So it got unveiled yesterday. But what is also interesting is that this is the last civic gift, the last gift to Seattle from the late Bagley Wright. He died last summer. And you might know Bagley Wright because he was one of the creators of the Space Needle, or you might know him from Bagley Wright Theater at Seattle Repertory Theater. Bagley Wright and his wife, Virginia Wright, have been involved with the Seattle Art Museum since they moved back to Seattle in the mid-1950s, more than 50 years. He served as an interim director of the museum, as did his son Charlie Wright, who served up until last year when the new director was named. So Virginia Wright has sort of picked up this idea from her husband and shepherded it through, and I got a chance to sit down and talk with her last week, and I wanted to know how they got involved with Mirror in the first place.
I went to Doug's presentation at the museum, but Bagley didn't. And so I went back, and I was just telling him about it. And he, as I say, he wasn't familiar with Doug's work, didn't really know his name, but he understood right away how this project could transform the facade of the museum, and I was surprised because he that wasn't his typical mode. He was more deliberate. So for him to just seize on it and be excited by it was surprising.
As I understand the concept, and maybe you can explain it to me more, it is as much about civic engagement as it is, and conversation, as it is an art piece that illuminates this building itself or this institution?
Well, I think it's both, really. But I think probably what struck him was that the entrance to the museum needed to be marked in some way, some dramatic way, and because it looked like the entrance to a, an office building. So I think maybe first in his mind was that it would be a dramatic embellishment on the facade.
So how did you present this to him after you were at the presentation? What did you say about it?
Well, I just the facts, ma'am. I mean,
You were just reporting back.
Yeah, just telling him what the idea was. And so anyway, the next day Doug came over to our apartment and told us more, and Bagley was willing to commit. Of course, I think if he'd known it was going to take 5 years, I don't know.
He's done a lot of other projects. He did a lot of other projects around town that took more than 5 months, that's for sure.
Well, that's true.
This is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's going to be cool on the outside of the museum. There's going to be a big public celebration. But it also is kind of the last big work that will be visible to everybody that Bagley has given the city, and there are many of them.
Well, that's true. That's true. It was the last project, and it looks like it's going to be a winner.
We're sitting looking at the concept. So when you stand outside right now, it's not turned down, you see essentially some external glass is what it looks like. That looks like sort of a panel that sticks out from, probably like fourth story height when you're underneath it. And that's it. It's not turned on right now. What will we see when the switch is flipped?
Well, I think one of the amazing things is that what you see at that moment will never, ever be repeated again. It'll be constantly renewing itself. I mean, you think of a work of art as something you go to, it's a familiar sight. This is the opposite. This will never repeat itself. It'll be constantly responding to all kinds of impulses.
Because it's a mirror, but it also has LEDs, there's lights, it's it's not like I just hung my bathroom mirror on the side of the art museum.
Well, and I can't remember the phrase he uses, but he talks about living architecture or something like that. He uses his piece to point up architectural features of the facade. And so those fingers of light that will move up the facade will be enliven the architecture to an amazing degree.
I was thinking about you, both of you, the Wrights' history with this institution, how fitting it is that this last big project of Bagley's would be to highlight an organization that you guys have been involved with for more than 50 years. Do you hate thinking about it that way?
I guess it is. Yeah.
Isn't it that long?
I joined the board in 1959, so yes.
A few more than 50.
Yeah.
What was this? I mean, this is, I think you live across the street.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but when you came back to town from New York, there was Volunteer Park, right? That was it.
That was it.
I know you are not art historian by academic training. You worked in a gallery. What prompted you to involve yourselves in this institution?
Well, it was the major show in town for art. So I don't, you know, if it was going to be that or nothing, really.
Nothing, not an option?
No, I wanted to get involved with something that had to do with art, so...
There wasn't really much of a contemporary collection when you got involved, was there?
No, there wasn't. I mean, there was a enormous or a strong group that supported Northwest art, you know, and Toby and Graves were sort of sacred names around the town. But for anything outside the Northwest, it was they had, you know, blinkers on, and it was Dr. Fuller was. That wasn't his field at all. But, you know, the museum, Sam Francis's, one of his first shows was at the Seattle Art Museum. So there was some, but it was not enough, not enough.
I interviewed Bagley about four years or so ago, and he said, well, you know, we just wanted to do something, and so... it wasn't just you two, but you two and another sort of group of peers said, oh, you know, let us just do contemporary art. And I wasn't sure if that was at the time of the World's Fair or before it.
No, the World's Fair was the transforming event. But we, at that, just I think it was 1964, three or four, a group of us went to Dr. Fuller and said, look, if we raise the money each year, can we then bring a show of contemporary art to the museum? And, of course, and he said yes. I mean, it would never happen in a professional museum, but we played curator for maybe 10 years or so. We brought shows from out of town to that were contemporary, and the legacy from the fair was... the Flag Pavilion, which became a wing or another location for the Seattle Art Museum. And that's where our contemporary art shows were installed.
For 10 years?
Is that right?
You mean our group was...
Yeah, well, though the shows... Because I remember the pavilion. I remember
yes.
I remember going down and seeing shows. And I can't remember... Was it with the construction of this building that that changed?
Or
we moved... We abandoned or didn't have exhibitions in the pavilion, I think probably in the 80s, because we were then planning the downtown building, and that was supposed to take care of all our exhibition needs.
So that's one. It sort of did. There's now the third location as well.
Right.
So... Were you on the board in 63, 64 still, or was that when Bagley was directing?
Well, when he came on the board, I went off, so I can't remember the chronology, but it was...
But you've pretty much, there's always, it seems like there's been a right.
That's
because
right.
Now, is Charlie still on the...
He's a chairman of the board, yeah.
Okay, so this is it's kind of like an adjunct family business.
A little bit, yeah.
When you probably don't have time to step back and think about the evolution of this institution, but over that time of your involvement, it is, I don't even know how to describe how different it is.
It is different, but it was, you know, due to a lot of things, like all the money that happened in Seattle with computers and coffee and things like that, that I think raised the ante for the museum. And moving downtown was an important thing.
In terms of visibility or in terms of institutionalizing this organization?
Well, making it more, you know, downtown more accessible, giving us more room for exhibitions, I think all of the above. It was...
So at the same time that you and Bagley were involved nurturing this organization, you also had your own private collection that you were pursuing, and at some point it comes here, we've seen part of it, but how did private collection dovetail with your work with the museum?
Well, I think it was a interesting challenge for me to think of that I was buying for a museum, so it made me more, I hope, more conscientious and more thoughtful and more careful.
Did you always know that your collection would come here?
Well, that seemed like a great thing to be doing, buying for a museum. It gave it more importance to me, and so, yeah, pretty much always.
Well, I'm curious about you and sort of personal tastes. Is there a line between your personal tastes as just an audience, an appreciator of contemporary art, and what you choose for your own collection?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that. I bought what I liked, indulged my personal taste, but I also thought, what is the significance of the artist in question? Is he for real? Is it a flash in the pan, or is he for the ages? So first of all, I had to be wowed by the work of art. I wouldn't have jumped for it or spent money on it otherwise.
You personally also have a legacy of public art, Western Washington University, and also, I hope I get the order right, Adjacent Against a Pond down on the waterfront was your gift, right?
Well, no, it was. I was involved, but it was really, again, this Contemporary Art Council. We raised the money, most of it for it. There was 1% for art money, city money used too, but basically it was our joint project, which was great. Dr. Fuller allowed this Contemporary Art Council to exist. We supported the museum, but we also did projects outside the museum in the city. So he could have called us on that because we were getting our tax deduction from supporting the museum.
You liked this kind of art. You thought it'd be good for the city. Looking back on, 1964 to the present time, we are now known as a center of contemporary art internationally, I'd say. Not necessarily artists working here, although there are those, but also a destination for people to come in and see what you helped build, or at least started to help build.
Well, I think it may be outstanding as a Seattle be outstanding as a city that has a lot of outdoor public art. I mean, there was sort of a vogue for public art, outdoor art in the 70s, and Seattle with, you know, the Henry Moore in front of the Seattle First, other projects. I was involved with the Hammering Man outside this building. So I think we're unusual for a city this size to have so much public art outdoor.
Your art involvement's been pretty much visual art related. Was it Bagley who kind of ventured out? I know he was so involved with the Seattle Repertory Theater.
Yeah.
So was it he who sort of had other passions as well?
Yes. Oh, I think theater really was a passion for him. He was, I think if he had you know, he was a newspaper man to begin with, but he was very good at writing, and theater was a passion for him.
He was, I think, a poet at some point.
Well, he did, you know.
He told me he liked it.
Yes, he did. Literature was a passion for him, books and poetry. And
this is your hometown, but not, it was not Bagley's hometown. He adopted it, and together you made a huge cultural mark on the city, from the Space Needle, our icon, to this museum, and you're still working. When you look back, how do you judge what you two have done for this place?
Well, I think really what occurs to me is that we just had an awful lot of fun. We did what we enjoyed doing. It was our idea of fun, and the city was played ball, which was very nice of them.
Do you consciously walk by and say, oh, we made that happen?
In some cases, yeah. I love to go down to see the Michael Heiser and Myrtle Edwards. Yeah, it gives me a lot of pleasure.
What next, then, for you? What will be the next big project?
Well, who knows?
I should say she's just put her hands up in the air and shrugged because nobody can see you.
I'm sort of petering out of ideas and activities, but hey, who knows? Maybe something will come along that is a must do. We'll see.
That's arts patron Virginia Wright. Her husband Bagley's last cultural gift to the city, mirror, is installed on the northwest exterior of the Seattle Art Museum. She spoke with Marcy Silman. This is Weekday.
What's on the minds of Seattleites these days? We're going to take that up with a panel of cultural connoisseurs in a minute.
Hi, this is Patricia Murphy. KUOW's spring membership drive starts April 1st. And you know what gets the momentum going? You. With your pledge of $1,000 or more, you can inspire listeners to call and have their donations matched by your challenge. For details, email majorgifts@kuow.org or call 206-221-2732. Thanks.
. 52 degrees in Seattle and partly sunny. Forecast says partly sunny all day, no rain expected, an afternoon high of 60. Tonight, cloudy, low of 42, and tomorrow, Tuesday, partly sunny again, with a slight chance of showers and an afternoon high of 59.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Sounders FC. The Sounders FC have advanced to the semifinal round of the CONCACAF Champions League, where they'll renew their rivalry with Mexico's Santos Laguna, Tuesday, April 2nd at CenturyLink Field. Ticket information is at soundersfc.com.
10:38, I'm Bernard Ouellet. On this relatively sunny day, we're going to listen back to a distinctive sound from last week, the sound of snow melting. What is the sound of snow melting? Sounds like a Zen riddle. We will unriddle the riddle in about 15 minutes.
That's very good, Bernard. I did not know you were doing Zen koans today. What is the sound of snow melting? We're going to get to that. First, we're going to get to a little bit of what's been happening in the zeitgeist, the milieu, the water around the chat room, or in the chat room around the water cooler, or in the Stammtisch. As Bernard likes to call it, our Monday morning gathering of folks who've been thinking about stuff and things. Relina Joseph is a professor in the University of Washington's Communication Department. She is also the author of a new book, Transcending Blackness, From the New Millennium Mulatta to the Exceptional Multiracial. Just to like jump right into critical and controversial issues, right?
Yeah, always.
It's good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
And though we're going to touch on these issues about the book, I hope you will come back. We'll have you back. We'll just focus, dive right into the book.
I'd love that.
But what you've written about is exactly some of the things we're talking about. Roger Levesque is a former Sounders football club player In 2010, he was ranked 19th in the USL First Division Top 25 of the decade, a list of the best and most influential players. That is an honor, yes?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, no, getting old at this point. I think that's what that means.
Getting old, because now you're a graduate student in business at the UW.
Yep, over at Foster School of Business. Yeah. I just started in the fall.
In one of the nicer buildings on campus.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very fortunate to be able to have class in that building every day. It's great.
Yeah, it is great. And Mark Baumgarten is the editor-in-chief for the Seattle Weekly, newly installed. Good to meet you, and good to talk to you.
Yeah, nice to talk to you too, Steve.
Excited?
Absolutely.
Got the weight of a newspaper partially on your shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. It feels pretty, pretty daunting, but I'm up to it, so...
They would not have brought you in otherwise.
Right? I hope not.
No, of course. They know you got what it takes. Where were you before? Just before this?
I was at City Arts for about 4 years before this. I was at Sound Magazine before that, and I was at Willamette Week down in Portland for a number of years before that. So,
the reason in part I asked to hear that, but also City Arts, one of your former colleagues, Leah Baldus, mm-hmm. has been a guest with us, and City Arts takes me to sort of, I remember I mentioned off the air, I said there's sort of one thing I wanted to ask you that was not on our list, and this Virginian Bagley Wright installation mirror got me thinking about it. Also, a conversation we had a little earlier in the hour about whether the creative class, which we will now define as young people with college degrees who come to cities because they want to be a part of city life, give cities the vibrancy they need. And so along with that would be sporting events and sports people, alternative newspapers, as well as the mainstream newspapers. I don't know if you like the phrase alternative anymore, but we'll consider that. And universities that are part of cities and downtown urban downtown urban core universities. So just that as a way of thinking about it, how does the city feel to you right now in terms of its vibrancy or lack thereof?
It feels very vibrant right now. And I feel like sports has a lot to do with that, actually. I mean, there is an energy that's pulsing through the city. Having sports teams that feel like they matter, I mean, it does a great thing for a city's confidence. And I think that Seattle sometimes has lacked confidence, and it's really nice to see it kind of with a little swagger.
It never hurts to have a decent economy underpinning all these things, right?
Right.
How does the city feel to you? Erlina, that does it feel a little swaggery in a good way?
I think that happens for me just because of the spring. So even though I've lived here for 8 years now, and it's always a reawakening.
Where did you come from?
From California.
Ah, yes.
One of the many transplants.
But the spring, yes, would be a moment of hope for a Californian.
Absolutely.
Before they are dashed in May.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm in a household of basketball fanatics. So everyone is very excited, not just about March Madness, but of the NBA returning potentially.
Yeah. Roger, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Maine.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Hence playing football in the snow.
Yeah, exactly. And then spent a few years down in California, down in the Bay Area, and then have been in Seattle for 9 years.
So how does it feel as you've settled in? What's the tone of the city for you?
Yeah,
you
I mean, I love it here. I love the West Coast and then love the city of Seattle. For me, it's the people, and that's – I really got to know the community representing the Sounders organization for a number of years, and that's what excites me about this place. People from all different walks of life, you can find just about anything. So,
it is interesting what you said about sports being a big part of this swagger, because in that argument about what do we invest in cities and the creative class and making sure there's places for people to eat and drink and share their art and talk about things. In those books, there wasn't a lot of talk about the importance of sports and sports centers. And yet, I think you're right. I mean, part of the conversation we're having is because, will we or won't we build a basketball arena? How important is it to have a nationally ranked, internationally ranked football soccer team here? I'll have to differentiate if you don't mind.
Yeah, the Sounders are very fortunate to be able to play right in the city. You see that kind of around the U.S. and some stadiums are outside the city, and it doesn't quite have the same feeling that we get here in Seattle, where a game on Saturday, you know, just brings people from all over the place into this city. And that, I think, adds to the vibrancy, too. You know, it helps that it's 40,000 people coming into games. But I think that definitely adds to the excitement, is what Mark is saying.
I think that one of the things that is problematic with what Richard Florida was doing was that he sort of was compartmentalizing people and not really recognizing that as the creative class matures, that they're actually going to become more integrated into their communities, and sports is going to become a big part of who they are, and that there are, you know, a lot of parts of the city that are just about being somebody who lives in the city that you love, you know, and it's not necessarily that you have affordable workspace and, you know, and good coffee shops, but it's all of the parts of the city that we love.
What do you think about the argument that folks are making against putting the basketball arena in because it could undercut the work of people who drive trucks, people who are stevedoring, people who are dependent upon the blue collar port jobs? You know, relating it back. Well, just as an opinion. You don't have to be an expert, but as an opinion, what do you think of that argument when they talk about building a basketball arena?
Right. I think that part of the culture of a city comes through sports, as we've been talking about, and maintaining, holding on to those blue collar jobs is essential. And I think that with all of the creative minds at work with the arena and with working on the new project of returning the NBA here, that we must be able to come up with some type of a compromise to be able to preserve those jobs and also to bring the franchise back here.
Yeah. Would you feel that we weren't following that sort of energy if the stadium ended out in Bellevue or Kent, or does it need to be in downtown?
I don't think it needs to be downtown. But I'm more of, I say that I think that it will end up being where it needs to be. You know, I mean, I really don't think that that it necessarily, like, you need to have it in a specific locale. Stadium districts are, you know, was another, that was like the pre-creative class dream, which was that, oh, if we create stadium districts, then, you know, the economy will follow and everything. And it, you know, it's proven out in many different markets that hasn't really worked. And so, you know, again, like, we can't rely on one thing, you know, and if the stadium doesn't work in Seattle, then it doesn't work in Seattle. And maybe it's in Bellevue and, you know, the city will deal with that.
City benefit from it? Do you think the city would benefit if it was in the city of Seattle would benefit if it was in the city of Bellevue?
I don't know. It's interesting. You know, I think the at this point, a lot of folks you know, in that stadium or stadium district south of the city are worried about traffic.
Yeah.
I know that's one of the biggest things that arguments that I've heard. But yeah, I mean, I agree with Mark, whether it's, you know, in Seattle or in Bellevue. You know, I think just having the franchise here would be great. It'd be great for the city. I know there's a lot of fans and a lot of people trying to work on it and have it work out. But, you know, I think wherever it ends up is exactly where it's supposed to be.
Did you get stuck in traffic when you were leaving the stadium after a game?
I usually was the last one out of the locker room.
That's what I figured. You guys would be last.
Yeah.
Well, part of the reason I was sort of curious about that was because of what you were thinking about, Mark Baumgarten. An informal discussion taking place in Seattle about a possible bid for a 2024 Summer Olympics. Could we do that? Could this city handle the Summer Olympics? 2024, I think the tunnel will be done.
I think that the city could handle it, but is it good for the city is the question. And I'm of, you know, the kind of cranky Howard Kunstler urban development mind where I believe that a city needs to be the outgrowth of the people that live in it. And I see the Olympics as being something that is put upon a city and kind of used by the leaders of that city to maybe, you know, it's rationalized by pushing, by saying that it's going to create things, like it'll create transit, you know. And I think especially what we're looking at, and one of the things that's going to make the bid very tantalizing, I think, for city and state leaders is the fact that we do not have a state tourism office right now. And we're one of, I think, maybe the only state that does not have that. And you look at the numbers that are coming out, and as, you know, the tourism numbers nationwide are like 5% growth, and Washington State was 2% growth last year. And if that keeps going in that direction, it's going to mean major problems for the tourism industry. And the Olympics are a great advertisement for a region.
What do you think, an Olympic bid, a opening ceremony, Space Needle exploding with people?
I can see it. But I wonder, where would the Olympic Village be? Have you heard any rumbles about where that might
be? Where would that go?
Yeah.
I think they'll just raise East Lake, and the ducks will go through there. You know, it'll be great.
Oh, Lord. Would you like to see an Olympics in this town, Roger Levesque?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's just such a big investment, you know, as far as infrastructure. And, you know, I think it would take someone or a group of people really to kind of champion the idea and to really, you know, have that passion and that fire to actually get it done. You know, I unfortunately didn't make it up to Vancouver when they had the Olympics up there, but heard great things about it. So, you know, and 2024 is still, you know, a ways away, and a lot can happen in between now and then. But I'd say selfishly, just, you know, to see the city be in Seattle and to have something, you know, of that magnitude, and I would love to see it.
Would we be a good host? Would this city be a good host for the Olympics? What do you think? You've lived here long enough. What do you think?
I think
really
so.
Impressive.
I think that we would, you share. I think that there would be a tremendous amount of excitement around the Olympics, and we are a fairly warm city, at least in the superficial greeting tourist kind of way. So I think that it would be an exciting moment.
Mark Baumgarten, you brought it up. Do you guys think we'd be a decent host for the city?
Yeah,
for the
Olympics? I think we'd be great hosts. But, you know, after the event is over and the parade is left, you know, what are we left with? I've walked through enough, you know, Olympic villages of Olympics past, and they are underutilized wastelands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that they're maybe getting better at figuring out how to use those structures. But I don't know. It would take a lot to convince me that it's the right thing to do.
They still need student housing over here at UW.
That's
so
right.
Maybe that would generate some student housing.
I don't think any of you guys were here for the games that took place in 1991, the Goodwill Games.
Yeah, that was a boondoggle, wasn't it?
Well, it was. I don't recall the boondoggle in terms of the cost, but I do remember seeing lots of people here, and it was pretty exciting to see athletes from all over the world on the UW campus where they had the Athletes Village. That was a lot of fun to see all those folks and talk to, you know, athletes from all over the world.
Man, I'm just a crank.
All right, you're following you and I are agnostic, but we're watching, really, into Joseph. But Roger Levesque and Mark Baumgarten, you're following the NCAA, the tournament?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And your team is?
The University of Minnesota Golden Gophers.
How are they doing?
They lost yesterday to Florida.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Oh, did they lose to the team?
No, but
not those guys.
But if they would have won, they'd be playing Gulf Coast this next weekend.
The number 15 Florida Gulf Coast University. They made it into the Sweet 16. Huh?
Man, they're fun to watch.
Yeah,
yeah. They're just on a different level emotionally than any of the other teams, I think.
What's your team, Roger Levesque?
You know, Husky currently was a Stanford Cardinal fan, having gone to undergraduate there, but so neither of those teams threw for at this point.
And yeah. Gonzaga also, you could have rooted for Gonzaga as Washington State. They didn't make it through.
No, unfortunately, no longer have them to push on as well. So yeah, the Gulf Coast team, definitely exciting. Always, you know, always good to root for the underdog, and just the way they play. I mean, I think it was just a highlight film, you know, watching them just at one alley-oop after another, pushing the ball up the court, and love to see that. So it's just an exciting time of year. You know, those first 2 days of the tournament, that Thursday, Friday, where there's basketball from 9 a.m. all the way till, you know, it's time to go to bed. You know, two of my favorites. so I'm definitely into it.
In your house, March Madness? Yelena Joseph?
Lots of March Madness. Yeah, I'm married to a former college basketball player.
And, oh yeah,
and he has made sure that our children are following his ways. So they filled out brackets and they've been religiously following along. 7 and 9 year old.
Do they come to you and say, "Hey, do you know who won yesterday?"
I'm always in the room, but I'm somehow always doing work, and they kind of know that I'm not quite, it's not quite registering.
Yeah, very funny. All right. I want to get to this just because there's so much more about our culture when we look at, when we listen to Jay Leno talking about NBC executives stabbing him in the back, and we hear about, you know, will they hire Jimmy Fallon? It's sort of like millionaires talking about this esoteric mm-hmm. thing. And what I was wondering about is, what is it telling you about the state of broadcast television today? I mean, Rolini, you write about culture. You write about the shift in American, who are Americans. And yet, these are white guys talking to white guys about white guys.
Yes, they are. And it's interesting to see even now at this moment when the market is so segmented, so that we have all these different hundreds of cable choices. We don't just have Leno or Letterman or even Jimmy Fallon. We can go to Colbert. We can
Stewart.
Go to Stewart.
And yet they're
exactly
they're all still white men.
Yeah, yeah. In this particular moment, so there's something about. The host of culture, if you think about the late night television genre, the mix of current affairs, a little stand-up comedy, a musical host or two, the person who you see as ultimately taking the reins makes sense as a white man. He is the person that people feel the most comfortable inviting into their homes in the late evening hours. That's what's main change. And I have to say that I am a Jimmy Fallon fan. And yet it is interesting that how little the shift has occurred.
What was Arsenio Hall's, impact after all these years? And I'm trying to think of some women who have hosted these late night shows.
Right.
Chelsea Handler mm-hmm. has a show.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, yeah, that's been it. I mean, what was Arsenio's impact?
And he will be returning in the fall. I don't know if you've heard. It's going to be Arsenio again.
A talk show.
Yeah, as a talk show, as a late night talk show host. I'm not sure of the station, but he will be on. He brought a certain amount of cool to the late night talk show genre at that moment. I don't know now, 20 years later, if he's going to be able to deliver on the same cool. Those iconic moments of Bill Clinton, for example, going on and playing the saxophone that happened on the Arsenio Hall show, the type of mainstreaming of hip hop culture at that moment that happened through Arsenio.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was a blip as opposed to a sea change in the way in which we saw late night talk show happening.
Well, and then now you have the most popular Jimmy Fallon clip ever is probably him and Justin Timberlake doing the history of hip hop.
That's right.
Like three different times.
Mm-hmm.
So you have two white men who have co-opted that, which is nothing new.
Right.
I think that it's interesting to see, Joan Rivers was really the first mm-hmm. The first woman who was actually right. sort of in line to take Johnny Carson's seat, and then she bolted to Fox when Fox started, and that relationship was destroyed, and her show ended like a couple years later. But it's interesting to think, okay, well, if Joan Rivers had the engine of the Tonight Show behind her, like. Could she have been? Could she have filled that seat?
Hmm. Who do you watch late at night, Roger Levesque?
it's a little past my bedtime, to be honest. currently no TV in my apartment, so I'm I'll catch a basketball game here and there down at the local pub, but not a big TV guy.
Yeah, well, maybe that's in the course if you wanted to. You don't have to. You could just get it.
Yeah.
Some other time on the web, streaming. Mm-hmm. Do you stay up late to watch television, or are you also?
No, I'm to bed early now.
This is part of the new world. Do you stay up late?
I don't either. And, but I think this is the thing that, especially in talking to my students, my undergrads in particular, that a lot of them don't have TVs, and yet they watch everything. And they don't pay for everything, which is interesting, but they're able to watch everything. So I get tons of different forwards of different clips. Michelle Obama and Jimmy Fallon, for example, doing the history of mom dancing, which is pretty hilarious, as well as the history of rap, things that are coming through, so that even if you don't own a traditional box, that you're able to still keep up with what's happening in television.
And of course, as you mentioned, during the day, it is women who control those shows, and it is their voices. All right. Ralina Joseph is a professor in University of Washington's Communication Department. Roger Levesque is former player for the Sounders FC and currently a student at the UW School of Business. And Mark Baumgarten is the editor-in-chief for the Seattle Weekly. I appreciate you all talking to us.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll taste a little snow, a little bit of the sound of snow as we go out. This is Weekday. That's Cynthia and David on Whidbey Island wrote that they finally got their winter on the second day of spring, and snow came, and then it started melting. Send us a sound.
Sounds like a giant icicle.
It does, just running down.
Just running off of it. Don't stand underneath those giant icicles. That's kind of dangerous. It's 10:59, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Food allergies in the U.S. have more than doubled over the past decade. Food allergies now affect over... Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.